now. We're in the 14th verse of the 7th chapter. Racing along here. We're in the next chapter already. We've already done a chapter. We've been going too fast at that. Call attention to the 14th verse. You notice this is a beautiful summary of the splinter group movement. There have always been splinter groups in the church in every age. It was among the Jews, among the early Christians, and so on. And there have been over 100 now. Brother Russell.
Brother Newman?
Yes?
Could you turn your microphone?
Oh, this thing. Woo-hoo. Is it working?
No.
Well, then I have to talk up then. The 14th verse, and it talks about the splinter groups that always take place. You're always going to find them, and they're characteristic, and this is the way it happens. They've always been in the church and so forth. And you notice how rich this verse is. First of all, they were divided into tribes. You know the tribes. Every man according to family. The family is the basis of all these splinter groups, of which Russell Rich, who just died recently, Russell Rich has devoted his time to specializing on the splinter groups, which is over 100. There have been over 100 attempts to refound the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints by individuals who thought they had special revelations. And they all withered by the way, without exception. But these are the characteristics they all have. You notice, first, they are formed around families originally. And then families extend to kindred, that is, wider associations. For example, my wife is associated in various lines, polygamous groups up in Canada, all sorts of things. Distantly related, those are the kindreds. And then the friends. Friends join the group too. And they are all very peaceful. They want to get away and found a new Zion by themselves. They did not go to war with another, but they were not united. They all have different ideas about things. And invariably, they always form about a strong individual. They depend on the leader. When he's gone, the group usually collapses and disappears. You see that? And it says they had peace in the land. They didn't trespass against one another. But if you disagree with them on doctrine, or if you drop out or something, look out. Then they play rough, you see. They stone the prophets and cast them out from among them. The prophets were among these people, but if anybody had his own idea about the doctrines or started preaching, he was kicked out. And they not only kick him out, they denounce him, and the barons and so forth. Now, I personally was very closely associated with Glenn Denning and the Order of Aaron, and the Laffertys came to see me often here, and Bruce David and Peacock, who had a group going down at Manti and so forth. They'd invite me down, try to convert me and ask me about things and so forth. These ended in murder, these people. The Laffertys, Bruce David and so forth, they started killing. And then the LeBarons, another example. The singers are very local and so forth. But way back in, before Joseph Smith's day, Jemima Wilkinson in New York State, not far from where Joseph Smith was, preached preached the restoration of the gospel. They expected angels. They felt that people had fallen away, but they felt that the prophet, the Christ, had come again in the person of Jemima Wilkinson. As soon as she died, the whole thing just disappeared. Clendenning became inactive, and suddenly the Order of Aaron, you hear no more of it. All these have just withered on the vines. I say there have been well over 100 of them, and this is the way it happened. So this is quite a test for the church, isn't it? People are still breaking off. They're still saying, well, you can't do without me. I'll blow the whole thing wide open. Nothing can happen, and so forth. Why does it go on? Well, we're going to see. It's going to tell us why this happens now, and it's very relevant to what's happening today. Now, this is the difference, of course, in 15 here. Now, here we are entering a new dimension entirely. It's Nephi who makes the difference. Notice he's impressed by the appalling spread of the turnover here. The voice of the Lord had witnessed angels and had power. Well, he'd been visited by angels and seen power. This is the mechanism. This solves it. See, unless you're going to get this, we're just going to go on squabbling forever. The upper world, the other world, has to intervene sometime and enter into the picture. Otherwise, we're just going to go around in a circle and hold meetings and have our committees and conclusions and so forth and fight with each other, and you'll get nowhere. Reformation is not restoration. Restoration is the new word that churches are adopting now. They've adopted only since 1960. Before that, it was a dirty word. They say Reformation, yes, but restoration, no. The gospel was never taken away. But now, even the Roman Catholic Church is talking about restoration. They're restoring things. But he was And power given to him that you might know concerning the ministry of Christ. And he was an eyewitness, here was I talking about, to the quick return from righteousness unto the wickedness and their abominations. These lightning switches. He witnessed it, he was impressed by it, and so forth. And this is introducing something more now. The gospel is something more than a successful and a happy life or something like that. No, it's an eternal life, which is a different thing entirely. People don't talk about that. They don't think of it as real. But that's the one. This is what we're talking about, the eternities. We're introducing them into the picture now. And then he has powerful motivation here. From his vantage point, everything is black. Remember Plato's cave. In this world, we're in a cave, in a dark cave. The real world, the sun is shining from behind our backs, but we're facing the wall here and we see our shadows on the wall, and we say, that's the real world, that's the real thing. And when we get on the outside, we're absolutely dazzled by the sun, we're blinded by it, we want to get back to our comfortable real world, which is actually in the dark. That's what you have here. It grieved him at the hardness of their hearts. He went forth among them to testify, to minister to them. See, from his vantage point, they were in the cave, and he was grieved to see them there, and he went forth to minister to them. And minister is used a lot in the Book of Mormon. You see in the 17th verse here, to minister, when Christ comes and ministers, when angels come and minister, what do? To minister is to help people, to give people something they need, but above all, is to teach them the words. You minister with words. These were the words which he ministered. He had that expression used in 35 here, and so forth, when the Lord comes. And the angels come and minister to their children. The picture we get is he walks among them, they walk among them and chat with them, comfort them, discuss things with them, talk with the children, talk with the people. And that's a very clear picture that we have later on there, so impressed the greatest Lutheran divine today, Stendhal, Christopher Stendhal. He gave a talk on that here in 3rd Nephi, which he regarded as one of the great books of Scripture, though he's the head of the Swedish Lutheran Church. He's the Bishop of Lund, you know, the top man. But anyway, that 3rd Nephi made an impression. We'll get to that soon enough. But notice here, he ministered, and it was, and many of the things can't be written. They minister things that can be written. It's the words they minister, but they can't be written here. And here he says an interesting thing. You wonder why we've been taking things so slowly and so forth. And that's here. He won't write them down. If he could, a part of them would not suffice. Therefore, I'm not going to write them. I won't give you a part of them. You have to get the whole. You have to get the whole picture here. Otherwise, here, won't you give us just a few of these angelic words? He says, no. A part of them would not suffice. You must get the whole picture here. We must see what these verses have to tell us, and we haven't. We skipped through it. I got a letter from an editor of a Catholic journal here, and he just skipped through the Book of Mormon, for example, and there are lots of things he needs to be enlightened about. He's very nice in asking questions about it, though. Very fair. Well, he ministered these things, but these things can't be written. So that's how we study the Scripture. You don't study the Scripture in part, would not suffice. We don't go through these things, you see, on roller skates. You take a little time here. But Nephi ministered to them with power and great authority. So we ask this, part of the Book of Mormon suffice. He's given us as much as we can take and all we need and all that we should have, too. So that's an important note on curriculum, isn't it? And did Nephi's charisma turn the tide? Absolutely not. They were angry with him. Oh, I should be asking questions here. Well, here we go. Why do you think they got angry with him? Why do you think he offended them? Why do you think he worried? Notice what their reaction was. They didn't say, oh, the guy's a nut and just forget about it. He wasn't going around shooting people or anything like that. Why would they get angry with him? And it says, because it was impossible. They couldn't believe his words. He had proof. And you see what was the nature of that proof? Here we go. It's about time. I'm neglecting my duty here. Brother Tyrrell, what was the nature of the proof he gave them that they could not deny? You see it right here, don't you?
Verse 19 says, in the name of Jesus, he cast out devils and unclean spirits and did raise his brother from the dead.
And the next verse, they saw it, you see. They couldn't deny it. They saw it, denied it, they witnessed it. Of course they got angry. Well, what would shock them about that? What was the fatal mistake, the fatal crime of Jesus when they decided to put him to death? They didn't decide, the elders and the high priests and the elders didn't decide, and the Pharisees didn't plot against Jesus to put him to death until what miracle?
Raising Lazarus.
When he raised Lazarus from the dead, that decided him. Say, after this is too much. This went around, and so they decided from then on, they thought that he would have to be put to death. So here we have it here. They were angry because they couldn't deny it. It was a culture shock. You see, you don't like to be pulled out of a warm bed in a cold morning. This is a thing that made them furious. They were wild at them, just like they reacted to Joseph Smith. It would have been all right. They tell us now there were dozens of cults and revivals and nuts running all over the place in Joseph Smith's day. Why couldn't he be dismissed just like that? It was the angel Moroni that spoiled everything, see? And then he turns up with the Book of Mormon. And so the people saw it and they were angry because they saw his power and they couldn't deny it. And then, in spite of all that, though, would you expect there to be general conversions? Brother Thompson here? Oh, Brother Thompson? Two Thompsons. Thomas Thompson? Brother Thomas? The next verse. Is this the expected result? Remember the miracle stories of the Christian church from the 5th century, this century on, the golden legend and so forth. They deal the miracle stories. The apostles go everywhere in the world, and everywhere they do, all they have to do is perform a great miracle, and everybody, the whole city, joins the church. Peter makes a dead fish speak, and a whole city joins the church. Peter or John slide down on a sunbeam, and they do it in the theater. They wait till the people are all gathered in the great amphitheater. Then they perform these spectacular miracles, whereupon all the people are instantly converted. Well, that's the story that goes on in early Middle Ages. Is that the way it works with the gospel? It didn't work here, did it? It didn't work at all. And why wouldn't it work? I mean, with such... But few were converted. And the only ones that were converted, what converted them? Now, this Catholic editor writes me, it's a very important Catholic German, he wants to know the secret, why the Mormons are able to convert so many people, as crazy as they are. And he doesn't call them crazy. He has great respect, this, that, and the other. But he thinks the Book of Mormon is utterly ridiculous. But why is it that people join the church? Well, Saturday, I was visited by a Russian Jew who was a Soviet. Come to this country. He married a Yugoslavian girl. They're here, and you never have met such strong testimony. They've been in the church for 8 or 10 years now, and absolutely unshakable testimonies. Joined the church, Soviet Russia, as a Jew, you see. Well, what would convert him? What arguments would convert him? What demonstrations would convert him? Or his wife, for that matter. The firmest person I know who's been bishop and a bishop and a and he's been a what was he called him in the army anyway? You have to go and see the padre, yes. Well, but anyway, he's been bishop. He's a state president now. He's a fervid practicing Muslim, see? But he knows the gospel's true, and all the efforts that have been made to shake him are absolutely impossible. You can't do it, you see. Imagine people have ganged up on him, he's been denounced this, that, and the other. He believes, like the Brethren believe in that first edition of the Journal of Discourses, that Muhammad was a true prophet. As he says, as his uncle Waraka says, Lahati l'ummi, to this people you were a prophet. And that's what the Brethren taught in the early days in this church. But anyway, the fact that he was a fervent Muslim did not stop him. Nothing could stop him. And the fact that he got ill treatment and everything else did not stop him from becoming, was fervently converted to the gospel. And so it goes. And the strongest converts to the church in my mission, in the Catholic part of here in Germany, were the best Catholics, the most fervid Catholics. And you find priests, people like that. So, what converts these people? Well, this is it in this verse, and you 10 guesses to see what it is. Brother Thompson, what do you see in this 21st verse? What is it that converts them after all? They were visited by the power and Spirit of God. They were visited. Something came down. It doesn't mean it dwells in you forever after, something like that. But you receive a visit. A visit means something coming from afar to you, something coming and coming to you that wasn't with you before. And it is the power and Spirit of God. It visits you. And when that comes, you forget about all your arguments. Now, he was expecting me to give a long explanation, psychological, philosophical, historical, etc., why the church is growing the way it is. That's what this article is about. That's so puzzlesome. And there's only one answer. As Kresimir Sosis told me, I baptized him. He was a famous basketball player in his day. You probably wouldn't remember him. Kresimir Sosis, he says, he'd been here a couple of years and seen the way some of the people misbehave here. He was a famous. He was world famous, famous in Europe, a star, you know. He was in four Olympics. He participated in four Olympics, if you can imagine that. Gold medals every time. Well, but he says, there are 100 reasons why I shouldn't join this church, and only one reason why I should, because it's true, you see. And so he joined. He said, nothing can stop him. He's been very, extremely active ever since. Ever since then. That's been years ago. 15 years ago, excuse me.
What makes the other people so stupid in this area? You see some.
Well, what about us today? This is a theory that it's one of the great mysteries of the world, why we're so dumb, isn't it? Here we are, everlasting spirits. Why aren't you a lot smarter than you are? I ask that question, and I know the answer perfectly well. It's my own fault. I don't have to envy anybody else or anything like that. If I'm not a lot smarter than I am, it's my own foolish fault. I haven't used a tenth of 1% of our capacity, you see. We shy away from it. We're lazy. Not only lazy, but it's rather awesome, these things, you see. Whenever the angel appears, it says angels appearing here, and what's the first reaction? I'll ask somebody else this. This is a nice trick question. Is William Thompson here? Ah, Bill. What's the first reaction when the angels come to the shepherds in the field, or to Mary in her house, or to Zacharias in the temple, or to the apostles on the mount? They're scared stiff. They were sore afraid. And the first thing the angel has to tell them is what? Don't panic. I'm your friend. Yes. I'm an angel come from God, and I bring good news, you see. But why should we panic at an angel, the last thing in the world? Well, of course we do. Living as we do with our, we living in the depths here, and then talk about a culture shock when somebody comes like that, to scare the daylights. We're even scared by ghosts, and a ghost can't really hurt you, you know. But people are, they turn white as a sheet when a ghost sheet appears, you see, because it's different. It's this culture shock. It's from another world. But it's when it's something lofty and infinitely above us, then we ask the rocks to cover us and the mountains to hide us, rather than have to face this. And of course, the hardest test any of us will ever have to take in the judgment. Hell is a pleasure compared with having to stand in the presence of God and look in His face. You can have that, you see. This would be the worst thing that could happen. You just fold up. You just turn to a cinder as far as that goes. All your own doing. It's all been up to you. And the Lord's going to talk a lot about that here when He comes. So that was it. They were angry, and there were a few converted, and they were converted, were visited by the Spirit of God. And He did truly manifest unto the people. Now these verses go down here. And so He baptized them. They found a church here. And He ordains men unto this ministry. Now the 25th verse. Unto this ministry. Let me see if we had any shrewd questions here. There we are. Yes. And the baptisms, you notice in the 26th chapter here, verse, start picking up on the eve of the great disaster. Now chapter 8 is psychologically a marvelous thing, isn't it? Something I brought along, yes. This is the great destruction. Notice how it approaches it. It came to pass, according to our record, and we know our record was true, for behold, it was a just man. Why does he knock himself out to convince us? Notice second verse, if there is no mistake in the reckoning and so forth, he takes these first two verses to reassure us. And why do you think he does that after Brother Thomas comes? Brother Thompson? Brother Tolman. Brother Tolman, why do you think he puts himself out here to assure us now what I'm telling you is the truth? We recorded this as well as we can. We're trying to be as accurate as we can here. Is he going to report an ordinary everyday affair that everybody would take for granted? You get the impression, what is he preparing us for?
He's preparing us for the coming of the Lord.
But what's he going to... This, the Lord doesn't come here. All hell breaks out here, you see. No, it's a terrible time. So what is he preparing us for? Why is he saying, why does he have to reassure us that somebody's telling the truth here? Why would you doubt this? Yes, brother?
Because it's so unbelievable.
Yes, he's going to tell a whopper, see. You might not believe this, but this is what happens, you see. These things happen. That's exactly it. So he has to reassure us, make sure this is exactly the way it is. And you notice, not making it up, but he says, if there's no mistake, and again, he makes allowance that humans make mistakes, but it was an honest man. He did the best he could, keeping the record, and the year was the 33rd year after the Lord had passed away. And then notice how nicely psychologically he builds up here. You get in the... What's the sense of the... we're getting into literature now, but what's the sense of this fourth verse, Brother Towery? Is Brother Towery here? Yes. Brother Towery, what is the sense when he starts saying, like, there began to be great doubtings and disputations among the people, notwithstanding so many signs had been given? That's marvelous prose, isn't it? It's building up. There's a sign of tension. There's an ominous hush here. You know something's going to happen. Now, what's he preparing us for? What's going on here? And already here, we get this mounting tension. And then it begins with just... Yes, but he's preparing them here for something pretty terrible, you see. No, the great event comes after this. See, this is it, remember? The Lord, it is after the same thing happens in the old world. It is after Sinai. Remember, Sinai was a volcano and the earth shook and the people couldn't approach it. And anyone that approached were killed and they had terrible things in the crossing of the Red Sea. After these terrible upheavals of nature, then the Lord came and spoke to Moses and established the covenant. And it was after these terrible upheavals here, then the Lord comes and establishes it again. And in these last days, after the great upheavals, it's the last time he will come then he will come again and bring again Zion with him. So it follows that pattern all along here. But notice, this attention. First, people began to look with earnestness for the fulfilling of the sign. Space of 3 days, there should be darkness for 3 days, it's going to come. Then there began to be doubtings, then there's uncertainty, hesitation, disputations notwithstanding, restless, this feeling of malaise. People, something is going to happen like you have before an earthquake. And then they give the date here, the 30, for a big event, you see, the big bang. The 34th year, in the first month, the fourth day of the month, there rose a great storm. It just begins with an ordinary storm. These things always begin that way. And then the storm turns to a hurricane, you know. It begins to... where does the hurricane come from, the word hurricane come from? Anybody know? The Central American, Huracan is the god of winds. Huracan, the word hurricane, comes from the Aztec, or probably from the Toltec language. The hurricane was the god of the hurricanes, the great storms that sweep in from the Caribbean there. So the storm turns to a hurricane. We've all seen that happen. Well, I've listed the things here, and this is an interesting thing. You'll notice here the order in which these things are given. Remember, we've had all sorts of... We've oversimplified this picture the Latter-day Saints have. Brother Towery, you... Yes, Brother Towery over here. Have you, I suppose not in your day, they didn't teach it, but they used to tell us the Rocky Mountains and the Andes were the result of this earthquake. Would you believe anything like that? A lot of nonsense, isn't it? These mountains out here weren't formed in that, were they? What does this describe? It describes a good earthquake, 8.5 maybe on the Richter scale, not higher than that. Many cities were spared from the epicenter. It describes everything in its proper order, exactly as such an earthquake would occur, as is it given to us from the Sister Tremel. Is Sister Tremel here? You know who is Sister Tremel? Or Brother Van Werkum? Brother Van Werkum. He's giving it to us as he talking about these terrible things that are happening. Does he give us any figures, any numbers here? He doesn't give us any figures on the Richter scale or the other scale, the Wilhelm scale. And how is, yes, it's described in what terms? Is it described, you might say, in scientific, objective, and so on, as it appeared to people? It's described as eyewitness. It's an eyewitness account. It's from various people when this happened and this happened. These are exactly the things people would report that see it, you see. It's the impression it made. And there's no gross exaggeration here at all. We've seen a pretty good earthquake in San Francisco, but this is nothing. Yes, brother?
Now, I'm going back to verse 5 for a second.
Verse 5.
What it tells us the date that it happened. What do you think is the calendar that they use? Would it be the Hebrew calendar?
On the fourth day of the month? Yes, they're following... seems to be the solar calendar they're following, the lunar. They have both the lunar and the solar calendar, though. That would be a thing, because it tells us, for example, when the Moroni ended the war and caught up with the terrible, where his general Lehi went and murdered the Lamanite leader in his tent, Malachi. He says it was the first day of the year, and the weather was very hot. Well, of course, they were in the tropics. Couldn't make any difference as far as that goes. It was in the tropics. It could have been the equinox, the first day of the year, or it could have been the 6th of January, the first day of the year, which is Epiphany, the first day of the year in most Christian nations in Europe. Or it could be the 25th of December, which is the Roman first day of the year. But it has to do with the calendar, and it has to do, of course, when the sun and the moon, they don't match each other very well. But it has to do when the new year, it could be the agricultural year. But they know what it was anyway. And first day of our year, you see, we'll find that out. Well, somebody could figure this out, I think, from the Book of Mormon. And this is what happened. As we list the things this way, what do we have now? I listed them already. Ah, here we are. First, you start out, notice. Oh, and we parallel these things just to check them briefly from books on earthquakes here, which we did once. We start here on 262. And this is what happens. Aha. First of all, there arose this great storm, and then the usual thing, and then it became a hurricane, and then this phenomenal thunder, this thunder out of the ground, this unspeakable noise and so forth. First of all, there was, I say, about 11 on the Wood-Neumann scale, but there were some cities which remained, we're told in 815 here, some remained, whereas in the great Assam earthquake of 1950, the damage was total over a vast area. It was total, there was nothing remained after that. I have an account of that here, but I'm not going to read it. Well, we're taking the Book of Mormon events in order here and going them down rapidly. We'll first, better put them on the board, yes, first, a great storm and a terrible tempest, the hurricane. Then, major earthquakes are often accompanied by heavy rains, thunder and hailstorm, and violent tempests. So some specialists insist there are some indications that certain weather conditions may trigger an earthquake, as in the Japanese earthquake of 1923. It was accompanied first by a great storm, then a hurricane, then terrible rains and thunders, and then came the earthquake. And the Japanese seismologists maintain that the low barometric pressure was the trigger which set off the earthquake. Well, anyway, great earthquakes are preceded by great storms. Then there was this lot of noise, this terrible thunder, insomuch that they thought the thunder shook the earth, you see. And that's the impression you get. Now, here we're quoting from Eby's book on earthquakes and from Hex and others. In accounts of earthquakes, we're quoting here, we always hear of the frightful noise which they produce. But in addition, it seems that sometimes the earthquake can be heard before it is felt. This is difficult to explain. One should feel the shock before hearing. The thunder seems to shake the earth, since the sound always appears to come from the ground beneath the observer. Now, that's the peculiar type of noise we're getting here. It is not ordinary thunder, you see. It says the Yes, a terrible thunder, insomuch that it did shake the whole earth as if it were about to divide a thunder. Well, how could thunder in the sky shake the earth, shaking it apart? Well, as it says here, that thunder that precedes the earthquake, the major earthquake, comes from the ground. It's terribly loud, and it comes from under your feet. And the sound always appears to come from beneath. In the Assam earthquake, is quoting from the official report of 1950, one thing is stressed in all reports, the awful rumble that heralded the outbreak of the earthquake, a deafening roar louder than anything any of the witnesses had ever heard before. So you have this tremendous super thundering sound coming before, and it's time to run for cover. But where do you run? Not in the house. That's what wipes people out, isn't it? Well, then what comes next? Then, verse 7 here. There were exceeding sharp lightnings. Of course, that's what you're going to have, of course, with updrafts and downdrafts and all that friction up there and all those ionized particles flying around like crazy. You're going to have these terrific, exceeding sharp lightnings. Well, in a cumulonimbus, which is what you're going to get here, certainly a cloud that high, you always get lightning, and you always get hail and all the rest of it. And we're told that the great Guatemala earthquake of September the 11th, 1541, which completely destroyed the old capital, was preceded by the fury of the wind, the incessant appalling lightning and dreadful thunder were indescribable by their violence, lightning. One still unexplained phenomenon of earthquakes, we're told in Byerly's book on seismology. It says, all types of lights are reported seen. There are flashes, there are balls of fire, there are streamers. The terrible winds at Guatemala City matched the Book of Mormon high winds, with occasional whirlwinds, where we're told in the 12th and the 16th verses and the 13th and 14th verses of the next chapter that they carried some people away, carry everybody away, but there are these swift winds that carried people away. You know, Parley P. Pratt's wife was carried away by a tornado in Davis County and never heard of again. They used to have those, oh, we still do have awful winds up there. We don't have them down here. We're blessed here anyway. We're extra good people. In the Japanese earthquake of 923, the earthquake wreaks terrific violence, and the first thing that happens when an earthquake comes, fires break out everywhere. That's what happened here. Fires in turn set up minor tornadoes. In the Assam earthquake, strong winds raised the dust until visibility was reduced to a few feet. And the city of Zarahemla did take fire. Now, the major cause of earthquake death is buildings falling in cities. Earthquakes are not really very dangerous if you're away from the town. Tell us that. It's the houses. It's the buildings that do the discussion. As recently in Mexico City, a classical example there, quite recently. But what destroys the cities is the fires. The fires break out immediately because you have fires on stoves and so forth. All water mains are broken and the like. Things start burning furiously. Just in this local earthquake down on the Barcadero on the waterfront in San Francisco, the fire started out. There's no way you can control it. Of course, there are fires in the house. They didn't have wires disconnected or anything, but they cook on fires and they light with fires. So the first thing that happens in a major earthquake, everything starts catching fire, and this is what happened. The city, the whole city, known as the city of Zarahemla, did take fire, 8 and 8. But appear from the account of the Nephite disasters, the main cause of the destruction was fire in the cities. Verses 8 to 11 here. City of Zarahemla did take fire. The city of Moroni did sink into the depths of the sea. But and the city of Moroni, earth was... Well, this is another one here. The this agrees with the major city problem. Well, this is a quotation again. Earthquakes are largely a city problem, mainly because the first heavy shock invariably sets fires all over the town. The Japanese experience in 1923, I remember that. I remember the day that happened. We had a Japanese gardener, and he gave us all the details on it. Wind-driven flames were shown to be more dangerous than the greatest earthquake, he tells us here. Well, anyway, and now we have the tsunami that always follows on the coast. You see, cities have the tsunami. That's the great tidal wave that invariably follows the earthquake, and it drowns the cities. The city of Moroni did sink into the depths of the sea. We were told that it was on the coast. Of course, it'd be on the coast. Sank into the depths of the sea. And this is the tsunami. You know what? This is the Japanese word for earthquake. It's so regular. It's a regular phenomenon. They always include this in the earthquake. This is this tidal wave, sometimes 100 feet high. In the great earthquake of Lisbon in 1730, was it, the one that Voltaire wrote about and so forth, and produced Candide, 3,000 people went out and had a brand new jetty built for the city, and the people went out to escape the fall of the building and so forth. The people went out on the new jetty and to crack open and swallowed the whole jetty with all 3,000 people. That was a tremendous earthquake. That turned Europe into atheists. People said God should never have allowed that. Yeah, the whole city of Lisbon was just wiped out, and that's why that cynical story of Voltaire's about, that's what it's about, the Candide. Can you believe anything when God would do that? The city of Moroni did sink into the depths of the sea. This tsunami or sea wave, quoting again, whom we're quoting from 12, we're quoting from Tassieff, a book on earthquake, a very good book on earthquake called When the Earth Trembles. In the winter of 373-2 BC, we're talking about here, the last days of the Book of Mormon people, the city of Helika in Greece disappeared beneath the sea. Not a single soul survived. Very interesting there, you see, this is what happened. And here, the tsunami, the book tells us, is the most spectacular and appalling of all earthquake phenomena. It almost invariably follows a major quake upon the coast. Along with this, however, we have in the Book of Mormon record what seems to be a permanent submersion of coastal areas. The waters came up in the stead thereof and remained. You notice the ninth chapter, the seventh verse here, it tells us the waters came up in the stead thereof, in the place of what there had been everything else. And in the Chilean earthquake of 1960, that was Adelia, 100 miles of coast, 30 miles wide, sunk in the sea and is still there. Not much was reported about that. This Tassieff was the one who reported on it, and he is a specialist in that. He said, we would have taken these flooded stretches, permanently flooded, for coastal lagoons, if here and there we had not seen roads that ran straight toward them and into them, roads that vanished or sometimes showed under the stagnant waters, branching into what had been the streets of a town. And then in the New Madrid earthquake, we're hearing more reports about that recently, of 1811, two vast tracts of land, 30,000 square miles, they tell us, were covered with fresh water. Both the damming of streams and the bursting out of numerous earthquake blows or fountains flooding the newly submerged areas. And, of course, you're going to have volcanic activity with this. Central America is a string of volcanoes, as you know. And when earthquakes are active, and volcanoes are, because they're caused by the same thing, namely the subduction of the Pacific Plate, plunging under the continental front here, under the shelf. It's not under the shelf, it's under the continent. That's what produced Mount St. Helens and all the mountains along there, and runs down the coast here, and especially, of course, in that narrow land of Central America. So the earth was carried upon the city of Moronihah, and in the place of that city, there became a great mountain. In September, I got a picture of it here, in case you should doubt it. In September 1538, during a tremendous storm and tidal wave, a volcanic mountain suddenly appeared and covered a town near Puzzuoli on the Bay of Naples, and ever since, the mountain has been known as Monte Nuovo, or New Mountain. Well, there it is, carried up and covering the town, and there's been a very good documentary. We have it on Channel 11, come out about that earthquake in the town of Puzzuoli. It's been still ever since, but just in the last two or three years, the harbor has rose 15 feet. The wharf and the harbor has risen 15 feet above its former level. So things are active, and the town's being vacated now. More things may happen. But, since this book was printed, we have some beautiful examples of that. Surtsey in Iceland, that town, that prosperous fishing town, now you've seen the lava spurting up and so forth. Now there's this huge mountain over it. It's covered by the mountain with a volcanic mountain of ash and mostly clinkers, mostly lava. And others, Paracatin in Mexico. How old is that now? 10, 15 years ago? Anyway, it was after this came out. Paracatin is now something to see. It's a real mountain. There was no mountain. It was just a cornfield, dead level and so forth. All of a sudden comes a volcano building up, and in a year, tourists were going to see the new mountain, Paracatin. So these things happen. And it happens there was a city near it, like Monte Nuovo. That's the new mountain, which was in Politica Ligula. Well, I'll be darned, that's where it gets its name. And so it goes. And then what else do we have? What other phenomena? We got this phenomenon, the volcanic ones. And then, oh yes. The quakings did last for about 3 hours, verse 19, and of course the aftershocks, tremblings and groanings continued for 3 days. You always get aftershocks after. Now look, there have been no studies of earthquakes. What would Joseph Smith in New York know about this sort of stuff, or anybody else, as far as that goes? During which time the afflicted people carried on in a hysterical fashion, with frightful howling and lamentation for the dead and so forth. We saw that in Mexico City. And then there was this thick darkness. This was really something. A thick darkness. They could feel the vapor of darkness. Neither could there be fire kindled, so great was the mist of darkness. And when we talk about God did send down fire and destroy them, that's volcanic activity. Well, we recall the greatest catastrophe of modern times, Mont Saint-Pierre in Martinique in 1902. And Mount Pelee in 1906. Now, and what did the people die of? 60,000 odd people from Mount Pelee. This wasn't Krakatoa, which was practically a desert island. The 60,000, they were suffocated. They died of suffocation. The air was so thick. They died of suffocation when earthquake dust, volcanic and ash, steam and hot gases, mostly sulfurated hydrogen gas, took the place of air. In some areas, the Book of Mormon reports, the people were overpowered by the vapor of smoke and darkness. They were killed by suffocation, which is the cause of, again, a major cause of death in earthquakes, and so lost their lives, the 13th verse of the 10th chapter. And even without volcanic accompaniments, earthquakes do kick up a tremendous dust, as you know, accompanied, as Seberg says, by phenomenal vapors and astonishingly thick air. In the Assam earthquake, such a contamination reduced visibility to a few feet and made breathing a nightmare. According to 3rd Nephi 8, 21 and 22, however, the vapor of darkness was not only tangible, but it defeated every attempt to light candles or torches for illumination. And so we get Thera and Krakatoa, where the same thing happened. It says they couldn't light any more lights. Where have I got that here? Well, anyway, the Book of Mormon mentions, and then this is another one, of course, the rising and sinking of the land. Well, that's what happens. Of course, we're talking about plate tectonics here, see? Mentions the rising and sinking of the land, forming new hills and valleys. There's no mention of mountain ranges here or anything like that. It gives us The New Madrid earthquake, the one I mentioned in 1811-1812, over an area of 30,000 square miles, lowered the land to the amount of 15 feet in some places and raised it 6 feet in others. But the Japan earthquake in 23, over 500 square miles, some areas were lowered as much as 700 feet and others were pushed up as much as more than 800 feet, so that you had a 1,500-foot difference pushed up like that. I saw that happening one day going up to Santa Barbara. There was an earthquake along the coast. We were driving, and suddenly the whole mountain just slipped down like that. We've seen a mountain slip down here. It wasn't an earthquake. But that's what the hydrographic surveys showed after the Japanese earthquake. So the earth is cast up after. Notice, these things are mentioned after, when they had a chance to inspect the land, and they saw that it was all broken up and so forth. And some cities escaped total destructions. They didn't lie at the center of it, and so it goes. Well, we're told here, another quotation, Central America lies in the heavy earthquake belt, as well as being both coastal and a volcanic area. And this is a perfect setup for this sort of thing. And so we see seams and cracks everywhere, highways broken up and level roads spoiled, and many smooth places made rough. Well, you could go around and make a film of this, your own documentary. You see, it's just a big earthquake is what it is. It's not the creation of the North American continent. We're not dealing with continental drift and things like that. But this is one of the periods of destruction, one of the destructive periods. It was in other parts of the world from the same time. They date almost exactly the same time, about 30 AD. They date the great earthquake at Qumran, which is near Jerusalem, just a few miles away. The steps that go down and what they add to the water, what they call the baptistry now, the steps are split 18 inches like that. One side of the stairway drops 18 inches under the other. That was a big drop. That was a real earthquake at that time. Of course, that's a very active earthquake cone. That's the Jowf. That's the Great Depression that runs right down, which is a great rift, which forms the Red Sea and goes right on up through the Ant-Lebanon through to Baalbek and goes right up to the headwaters of the Euphrates. Well, anyway, this is a good description, but it's preparing for something now. This is just as we say, these things happen in the time of Christ, and so the changes, topography, have anything else here to lift out? So it was not a time of general extermination or mountain building. There have been such times of extermination. This is important for us to know today. Of course, a few years ago, it says since the 1980s, so I'm going to refer you again just to make your flesh creep, as the fat boy says in is it Dombey and Son? I wants to make their flesh creep. This recent issue, 1989, June, is devoted to extermination, the march toward extinction. And this is very relevant to our particular age because it is man that does the extinguishing, and the Lord explains that when he comes. He says, you are wiping yourselves out. So this is what the situation we're in now. Well, just read you the introduction here. Pretty sensational. I notice I included in here a quotation from Charles Lyell's Principles of Geology, which was used for many years here at the BYU. This is an 1892 edition way back there. It was in their library here. And it was the great discovery of the geologists that everything happens at a uniform pace, uniformitarianism, never any faster, never any slower. The same forces are at work everywhere with infinite slowness, gradualness. It's the secure Victorian idea, and Meliorism too. Things were getting better. Irresistibly was the expression. Well, this is the way it starts out here. The philosopher at last has become convinced of the undeviating uniformity of secondary causes, and guided by this faith, you know, by faith in this principle, often rejects the fabulous tales of former times, of violent upheavals and volcanoes and things, on the ground of their being irreconcilable with the experience of more enlightened ages. We just don't have those things happen. They just don't happen to nice people, you see. They tell of terrible events, but we know better, he says. And on the frontispiece of the cover, it says, this Puzzioli as a proof that things happen with infinite gradualness. And if there's anything, it proves that things happen very fast. Well, but this is the way this latest issue, less than 6 months old, of the Geographic says. During the same time, since the 1930s, as many as 100 acres a minute of the world's tropical forest, among most richly populated inhabitants of the earth, have been destroyed. Ecologists can only speculate about how many unnamed, unknown creatures have vanished with the trees. An estimated 1 million species will be lost in the next 25 years. Not 1 million animals, but 1 million species. I didn't know there were that many. 1 million species will be lost in the next 25 years at the rate of one every 15 minutes. Every 15 minutes a species, which has worked a long time to get going and has been around for an awful long time and has adapted itself to its environment and so forth, every 15 minutes it disappears. Well, something, the whole Earth is being readjusted. Something is happening. Something is preparing. Something's going on. These great periods of extermination, it goes on. Many scientists contend that our planet is experiencing its greatest mass extinction in 66 million years. At that time, the dinosaurs vanished along with between 60 and 80% of other animal species, and they vanished suddenly and were replaced suddenly. That's what it's talked about here. Trilobites, ammonites, triceratops, titanotherus, all were victims of at least 12 mass extinctions. There have been 12 mass extinction periods. They're outlined, their diagrams and so forth here. 12 times when almost all the life on the Earth was extinguished and replaced again. And this, well, let's read what it says here. Five of them immense. This was one, not one of the immense ones. This was worldwide, we know from other records. This is the time of Christ. But it didn't wipe out the human race or form new continents or anything like that. This is one of the bad ones, but this was one not of the immense ones. Five of them immense that our planet has endured since the fossil record of animals began 800 million years ago. Mass extinctions, the concept has hit science like a fireball during the 1980s. You see, a few years ago, we'd never dream of talking about a thing like this. This is going altogether too far. Now you're kidding. Of course, a few things go wrong. We lose a few trees or something like that. So what? That's the attitude, certainly, of my grandparents and parents who were in the lumber business and other things and mining and and they said, oh yeah, there's always plenty left. Ha ha. Well, concept has hit us during the 1980s, and of course suddenly, now we suddenly become environment conscious. This is a new thing. Well, it goes on here. Paleontologists have long realized the occasional large numbers of species disappeared simultaneously from the fossil record. The cause of these great dyings has remained obscure, but all that is changing. Innovative geochemical techniques are coaxing subtle secrets from ancient rocks. Fossils are being re-examined. Computers are finding provocative patterns in the extinctions. In the process, the rules of evolution are being rewritten. Evolution, we were so certain when I figured into BYU, we just had it down cold. That's the only way it could have happened. All rewritten now. And so is the 4 billion year history of life on Earth. Coase talks about the iridium-rich clay. Scientists now concur. Well, you may have seen last week, it was on BYU and Channel 7, also the same thing, called the Miracle Planet. It's the Miracle Planet, and it was a geological thing on the forming of the planets and on the periodic destructions through meteorites and so forth. Most scientists now concur that at least one great extraterrestrial object struck the planet. But the, what did he say here? Well, here we go. In the first years after the Earth was hit, dust blanketed the world. Well, this is what happened, of course. Yellowstone entire world caught fire. To get the amount of soot we find, as much as 90% of the world's forest must have been burned when this particular meteor struck. Winds of 100 kilometers of an hour would have swept the planet for hours, drying trees like giant hair. 2,000 degree rock vapor would have spread rapidly. This is a much bigger addition than this, you see. Mass extinctions do occur. They force a new perspective on the history of life and on the gospel as far as that goes, because we're talking about that too. Remember, Brigham Young said Adam wasn't the first man of that name who lived on the earth. He replenished the earth. Who knows? We won't talk about that now. Mass extinctions change the rules of evolution, explained David Jablonski, University of Chicago. He says, when one strikes, it's not necessary the most fit survive. Often it's the most fortunate. Did he say anything here we might want to talk about? And then when it returned, animal life exploded across the planet, the start of the Cambrian. When it comes fast. When it goes fast. It's not this slow-paced, infinitely slow, long thing. Hooty-hooty, well. So let's behave ourselves. There's some nice things, pictures and all that sort of thing. At least six mass extinctions. But the greatest of all will probably be caused by the human race itself, and we're making it now. That the upshot of this article is the most complete extinction is this. We go around and do a thorough job bit by bit. We don't do a just sweeping a clumsy job. We don't go in with a sledgehammer. We go and pick our way through and wipe out species after species, ending up with ourselves. So the Book of Mormon plays rough. It was not kidding.